don't want to promise, but next week I'll make sure to replace these pages in a way that they'll be clearer. I just don't have always access to the office here, and they asked me to fill in, so we'll be here on Wednesdays at 10:15. How many people in the audience, I'm just curious, would be willing to raise their hand with an affirmative yes? Are you interested at all in art?
Yes.
Nobody?
Yeah.
Oh, we have a few hands going up. Oh, one more hand. Okay, good. So for those who are interested in art, and you want to know a Jewish perspective on art, you're in the right place. And that's going to be our discussion at least today and next Wednesday. So I apologize to anyone who's not interested in art. And for you, if you're not interested in art, this is going to be real Torah Lishma, you know, Torah for the sake of Torah. But if you have an interest in art, as I do, then you might find this very interesting to reveal some of the Jewish attitudes towards art. Okay, please take those pages if you can.
But is there anything else?
That's what I have right now. So again, for those who will be with me next week, I'll try to do better with the photocopying. It's been a little bit of a nightmare, pardon the pun. It's a little bit dark here. Yeah. With the photocopying, but we'll believe that we'll do better. The story of art, as far as the Torah is concerned, actually begins in the Torah itself. And this is a verse that follows the Aseres HaDibros in Parshas Yisro. And the Torah says in Parshas Yisro, I'll read you the pasuk, it's a bit of an ambiguous pasuk, we're not exactly sure without Torah Shebal Peh how to learn this pasuk, but the Torah says, Lo tasun iti Elohei kesef. I read it Elohei because we're referring to idols. Velohei zahav lo tasun lachem. Now, the pasuk divides up into two precious metals. The idols were made of metal, whether it was silver or gold. And we're going to see as we go along that there is halakhic significance, not so much to these two categories of precious metals, but rather to the idea of precious. So when we're going to discuss a situation in which you come across something that could be an image that would be worshipped, it's important to distinguish between images of things that are honored, that means they have special significance, as opposed to images of things that are totally secular, mundane, that unless somebody worships them, you assume nobody would think of worshiping them. And we're going to discuss, for example, animals. Are animals generally worshipped? Most animals are not worshipped. Yet, we have something called the zodiac. The zodiac is made up of some animals. Not all of the 12 features of the zodiac are animals, but there are certainly animals in the group. Some of you may be willing to admit that you belong to one of those groups, depending upon when you were born. And the zodiac represents various stars up in the heaven, various constellations that were actually worshipped. The halakhic terminology in the Talmud for idol worship is avodat kochavim umazalot. We worship those who were guilty of this. We're worshiping stars in the heavens, mazalot, which means constellations. And the philosophy of this idol worship was that the constellations have to be worshipped because they determine our life. In other words, man is not given freedom of choice. He's under a certain star. That star will control his destiny. Obviously, the Torah was given to undermine and to completely reject such a philosophy. One of the fundamentals of our belief is, of course, freedom of choice. Our destiny is not controlled. We are given and granted freedom. What exactly is the extent of that freedom? That's a different issue. At some point, if they invite me here for a lecture on philosophy, for some reason, every time they invite me here, it's for a lecture on contemporary halacha. Maybe that has to do with the person who's usually here to teach, who couldn't be here today. I don't know. But contemporary halacha is also okay with me. But there's a deep philosophical debate amongst Jewish thinkers about the extent of our freedom of choice. But we definitely have freedom of choice in the most critical issues of ethics and moral decisions. Hence, idol worship, and especially the worship of the zodiac, that itself undermines our very fundamental tenet of the faith. Now, what is the Torah telling you? If you're careful about it, the verse is not talking about idol worship. Lo ta'asun. How do you translate those two words, lo ta'asun?
Don't make it.
Don't make it. We're talking about making something. We're talking about creating, manufacturing images. Those images have some connection to idol worship. And if there is a common idol worship, and a common kind of an avodah zarah, of idolatry in any particular period of time, as there was certainly back in biblical times, then anything that you do to create something that could be an idol and might generally be used as an idol, anything that requires a kind of a worship or what we call adoration, meaning you really respect this, then by making this, you are already touching or coming close to creating idols. Now, does it mean that you're interested in creating an idol? Does it mean that you made this image and you created it for the purpose of worship? Absolutely not. That's not what we're talking about. If that would be the case, I could end the lecture right now and go home, because nobody here is interested in creating idols and worshiping them. So we don't have a problem of worshiping these images. We have a problem in creating these images. And the Torah says, lo ta'asun, don't create these images. These images are made in a way that they're very elegant, and they engender a sense of kavod, of respect. And once you create those images, which are commonly used in idol worship, the Torah says you're going too far. Don't create those images. Now, what are these images? Well, the Torah says they're Elohim. They are gods. In other words, commonly used as gods in idolatry. But the Torah goes out of its way to say iti. E.T. literally translates as with me. Now, I just want to, for the scholars in the group who might want to really learn this thoroughly, because again, we only have today and maybe next Wednesday, we really don't have enough time to do a scholarly work on creating idols and images. But for those who are interested, I'll take questions in a few minutes. You would have to open up a Masechta Tractate Avodah Zarah, and you'd have to go through pages Mem Aleph, Mem Beis, Mem Gimel. I just mentioned that if there's anyone here in the audience who does have access to the Talmud, if you learn Daf Yomi, or if you've ever taken it upon yourself to learn Masechta Avodah Zarah, amongst the various statements in the Talmud, one statement has to catch our attention. And that's the statement interpreting the word iti. Lo tasun iti. Iti with me. And Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law of our rabbis, interprets the word iti as refer to a human being, because a human being is iti, a human being reflects what we call the image of God. So that in a sense, we could say that the most honored image, if you had a scale and you would give me a list enumerating different types of images, the most divine of them all And again, when I say divine, I mean it in a positive sense, but yet the flip side of divine is idol worship, if you follow what I mean, is the human being. So included in the images that the Torah is saying not to create is the human image. Now, any of you who've, all of you, I would assume, have been at some point in your life to visit a museum. And if, again, I'm not talking about a museum of modern art, but any other museum, a classic museum, will always have in it images of human beings. And that's what sculpture is all about. You walk into a museum and you'll see sculptures of some of the greats in secular national history. You will see sculptures of busts that have only the face. You'll see sometimes the body below the face. And this comes under the law of ethics. So we're going to take images and we're going to try to divide them up into different subcategories. One image will be reflective of the heavens. Now, what do I mean by the heavens? Here also we have to subdivide it. In the heavens, there are angels. Now, if you walk into any museum, again, I happen to be from New York City, so I'll talk about the Metropolitan Museum of Art, correct? You walk into the Met, and you will see galleries with images of the divine being, so to speak, meaning the angels. The angels are divine. And honestly, when I try to avoid those galleries, but if I happen to chance upon them, I'm taking a guess because the images look like ghosts, ghosts, right? They're very scary, very daunt. And not only that, when they paint images, not only of the angels, but even of their deities, right? So we'll mention our friend Jesus, if you know what I mean. Right? So you'll see a picture that is very gaunt, very white, usually very scary looking. Again, the exception to this rule, but that's for next week, is going to be the Netherlands. Because in the Netherlands, they had a different picture of Oso Aish, of that individual that I mentioned before. But classic art for religious purposes will project an image of a human being who's a god. Now, it's interesting that in the halachic literature, very often, the poskim don't want to mention the Christians. So instead of mentioning the Christians and Christian art, they use what I call a secret code word. And that's called Derech Amori. Now, the Amorites were one of the seven nations that occupied Palestine. These were the Palestinians of then, not the Palestinians of today, and they were idol worshippers. So when we talk about Derech Amori, that's a very negative term because it means a kind of a form of cultic idol worship, idolatry. And in the poskim, sometimes they don't mention the Christians because all the poskim unanimously assume the Christianity insofar as they believe in the Trinity, which means that a human being is a god, is a deity. That is idolatry of the first order. Instead, they'll use the term Derech Amori. But don't be fooled. We're going to soon see a tshuva, a responsa of the Chasam Sofer. Anybody know when he lived? Germany. If he's writing about Derech Amori, you know, they're talking about the Canaanites. How many hundreds of millennia did he live ago?
Early this century.
Correct. Well, no, he didn't make it to this century, but he lived in the 1800s. You know, we're not. Why is he talking about Derech Amori? And you'll see that when he discusses issues on Jewish tombstones in which they put images of human beings in a Jewish cemetery, in Jewish tombstones, and to say, you know, just to understate it, the Chasam Sofer, who lived in Prešburg, today it's called Bratislava, he goes ballistic against this because he holds that this is a violation of the law because it's an image of a human being. And the Christians, he calls them the Amorites, he doesn't call them Christians, the Derech Amori was to put images of Yashka on tombstones. Now, why were the Christians putting Yashka on their tombstones? Because what do you do at a tombstone?
Pray.
You bow down. So you want to bow down to Oso Ha'ish. Does everybody know who I mean when I say Oso Ha'ish? So I don't have to give him too much frontal profile, profile. The guy with the big J on his sweatshirt, right? So he's the one who's always, his image is always on a tombstone because that's where they worshipped and that's where they bowed. The poskim today, by the way, now I don't know, did the OU ever take you on a tour of cemeteries? Did they ever have such a thing here in the OU? Anyway, in many, many Jewish organizations, for people who come to Israel, will organize tours to cemeteries. We have amazing, amazing cemeteries here in Israel. I'm not saying there aren't any amazing cemeteries in Europe, but we're not doing too badly. I mean, you could see things on Harizasim that'll just knock your socks off. I mean, you'll see people who are buried in Har Menuchot that could knock your socks off, in the Chelkas Rabbanim. But what we're careful about is that if you look at tombstones in a Jewish cemetery, mostly they're pretty boring. What do I mean by boring? They'll have the name of the person who's buried there. They'll tell you perhaps where he came from, maybe where he was born. They'll tell you the date of his birth and the date of his death. But there are no great pictures of artwork on tombstones. And a lot of the reason for this is because although it seems that in one particular community, back in the 1700s, in Czechoslovakia, there was a custom to put all sorts of images on tombstones. The Chasam Sofer, about 50 years later, in 1850 or so, he stood up and argued. He was so opposed to it that he raised the possibility of cutting down the tombstone and removing those images from the tombstone. Because he felt that a cemetery is a place where Jews go, and what do they do when they get to a kever? They pray. Now, when I told you before that we might organize here in the OU a trip to see some of the amazing cemeteries here in Israel, and you don't even have to go far from Yerushalayim. You don't have to go all the way to Tzfat. We're going to add a proviso. And we're going to say the following. Be careful when you pray at a gravesite. Because when you pray at a gravesite, make sure you're praying to Almighty God. And there's only one God. Don't pray to the deceased. That itself undermines our religion. We don't believe in praying to the deceased. And I don't care what Hasidic Rebbe you're talking about. We don't pray to the deceased. We pray directly to God. So be very careful. When you get to a tombstone, a gravesite, maybe you're meant to be uplifted, you're in an emotional, inspirational mood, and it's appropriate for praying, especially for reciting tilim, but make sure you're not praying to the dead. So the Chasam Sofer was faced with the following situation. They asked him about a Jewish cemetery in Prague, and one of the great rabbis of Prague, after he died and they buried him there, they put images on his tombstone. And the local rabbis, years later, wrote to the Chasam Sofer, and they asked him, is this right? And the Chasam Sofer said, if I had the power to do so, I would remove parts of those tombstones that have images on it. And he was very careful about a graveyard, a cemetery, because that's where Jews come to daven, to pray. And we don't want to have images, especially not human images, on a tombstone where we pray and we bow, because that would be similar to a different religion, which he calls Derech HaMori, where they come and they bow down to an image, an engraved image on the tombstone of their parents or grandparents, of Oso Ha'ish. Then Chasam Sofer quotes an earlier tshuva, which dates back to the 1100s, the 11th century. And I'll just fill in a little bit of background about this particular tshuva. It was in the city of Mainz, Mainz was a city in Germany that was ultimately destroyed by the Crusades. I mean, we have a Kinon Tisha B'Av about that city. And there was a great giant, a posek named Rav Eliakim ben Yosef Mimainz. And he writes in a tshuva in the year 1170 that in a certain city in France, what they did was on the synagogue, they drew images of lions. Now, let me ask you a question. Why would we choose a lion on a window in a synagogue somewhere in Cologne, France? Why a lion? Anybody guess? First of all, Yaakov Avinu uses the Aryeh to describe and bless Yaakov Avinu, but to bless Yehuda. But above and beyond that, the lion is considered like the king of all the animals. So if you want to worship an animal, you know, the lion is very impressive. And Rav Eliakim was absolutely opposed to using synagogue windows for these beautiful portrayals of lions and other animals, because he said, now you're entering into a house of worship. As soon as you are involved in worship, the prohibition of altasim, lotasim came, becomes even more severe. Because again, once you're worshiping in a synagogue, what are you worshiping?
God.
You're worshiping God, and if there are these images in the synagogue, that's not a good thing. Comes along the Sam Sofer 7 centuries later, and he says that the same logic applies to a graveyard, not to put images on a tombstone. Now, I personally visited a cemetery in Poland. We were on a trip called Heritage. I don't know if you heard of it. Michael Burl runs a trip. And we went to visit a cemetery in, I'm trying to remember the name of the shtetl. Just 1 second. It'll come to me. Anyway, we were looking for a particular kever, and we found engravings and images on the kever. Now, what was the image that we found on this kever? It was Shisha Sidre Mishnah. It was all 6 sets of the Mishnah. I don't think that some Sofer would have a problem with that. No one's worshiping the image of the Mishnah. Why was 6 volumes of the Mishnah engraved on that tombstone?
Because he was a scholar?
Exactly. That was the way that they honored him, by saying that he knew the entire Mishnah. That's a whole different story. But when you start making images of human beings and other images of, you know, honored beings, then in a cemetery, says Chassam Sofer, that's not a place where you want to put these images. Now, the truth is that there was a cemetery, as I mentioned before, in Czechoslovakia. That's where they had images of human beings and other images that were engraved in the tombstones, in the matsevos. How do you justify? Again, in this case, we're talking about the chief rabbi of Prague. He himself, after he died, they put up a tombstone with images on it. Human images. How could it be?
Human images of who? The person
himself? Of the person who died.
Oh, okay, the person. They have that heart.
Says that some Sofer, it could be that in certain places on the face of the earth, they weren't so sensitive to making changes and inroads in Jewish customs. But here, in Prešburg, we have to be very sensitive. And the reason for that is, does anybody know what was the Chassam Sofer's life battle, so to speak? What was his, what word should I use, his greatest challenge in life? Who was he fighting against? Anybody know? Correct. He was fighting against the Maskilim and the beginning of the Reform movement. Okay. By the way, something is going wrong here, I think, with this tape recorder. I don't know. Maybe not. I'm just hearing noises, so I don't know if it's coming from here or not.
Excuse me, could you just repeat the pasuk?
Yes, please. I want to start with the pasuk, because everything we say always comes back to the pasuk. Lo tasun iti Elohei kesef Elohei zahav lo tasun lachem. Okay. Now, I'm not telling you that I'm justifying images on a tombstone in the city of Prague, but what I am saying is that the Chassam Sofer in his cultural milieu, fighting this battle against the Reform, he had to make sure that we would stay very clear of Christianity, because Christianity and Reform Judaism have a closer alignment, and it was very possible that in the Reform movement they would imitate the Goyim and do like the Christians. He took a very strong stand. So let's go back to the heavens. To make an image that represents God, absolutely prohibited. What about an image to represent the sun, the moon, or the stars? Absolutely prohibited. These are heavenly bodies, right? These are spheres up in the celestial skies that were worshipped by the idol worshippers. And the Rambam goes into great detail at the beginning of his codes for Hilchos Akum to tell us that initially they adored the beautiful celestial spheres as delegates of God, and ultimately they began to attribute powers to these celestial spheres. Then we go on and we talk about animals. Images of animals. Here, there's a little bit more room for what? For leniency. But there are certain animals, as we said before, in the zodiac, etc., that were glorified and that were adored and that were used in idol worship. We've got to be very careful about that. Now we get to the question, what about drawing a picture? When idols are made, that's what we call three-dimensional. What's the deal with two-dimensional? We get to another question. What if I didn't create this image? I'm allowed to benefit from the image. I'm allowed to possess it. Can I purchase it? So let's say, for example, there was a sculpture, full sculpture of a human being from head to toe. I didn't create it. I didn't violate the Sisu Lo Tasun. So as I told you before, the main sugyas in Avodah Zarah Daf Mem Beis, and there the Gemara establishes that there's an Iser called Shehiyah. That's very difficult to translate that word into English, but Shehiyah means retaining possession. So not only am I enjoined from creating these images, let's talk about three-dimensional images, but moreover, I'm enjoined from possessing them. So for example, if somebody wants to sell me a piece of sculpture, I'm not permitted to buy it. Because if I buy it, although I didn't violate the Iser, the prohibition that's explicit in the Torah, which is Tasun, which means to create it, but there's an additional prohibition called Shehiyah, which means I own it. I possess it. I retain my relationship with this image. Okay, that's as far as three dimension. But what's the deal with two dimension? So I gave you a photocopy of a wonderful piece of research by somebody by the name of Michael Zilberman, and this is published in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. So I'm just going to read to you one paragraph of very great significance. He says the following. This is on the bottom of page 110, going on to the top of page 111. If you're able to read it, kol hakavod. It's the first two pages that you have. The title of this section, the essay is made up of many different sections, is Creating Images of the Sun, Moon, and the Stars. In all these cases, if he makes three-dimensional images, and by the way, we're going to talk about astronomy classes, very often they make images of the sun, the moon, the stars, in order to teach students astronomy. And the question is whether that's permissible. He says there are protruding images, which means three-dimensional images, and then there is something called sunken images, in which you press something down And you are able to see, because of the contrast between what that which is depressed and that which is still at ground level, so to speak, you're able to see the image. That's called an image that is shokea. Shokea means sunk.
Yeah, sunk.
Now, the Gemara assumes that in both cases, there is a prohibition of creating images of the sun, the moon, and the stars, even if they're shokea, even if they're sunken. Then we have something called two-dimensional images. Like, for example, if you take out a piece of paper or you take a picture, you know, you make an artwork on a page, and you want to draw the sun, the moon, and the stars. And on page 111, he says, the issue of whether lotasun iti extends to creating imagery of the sun, moon, and the stars in two dimensions is a very complex issue, and it is a division, a controversy between the Rambam on the one hand and the Maharam on the other hand. The Maharam, who lived in Germany, in Rothenburg, he was more or less a contemporary of the Rambam, a little bit younger than the Rambam, but they were both Rishonim in a very similar time zone. And later on, let's say, you know, fast forward 5 centuries, what we have is a machlokus between the Shach and the Taz. These are two of the greatest decisors or poskim for us. And they lived at the same time about 5 centuries ago. The Rambam seems to indicate that we're not allowed to produce an image on a tablet. Now, if you produce an image on a tablet, that sounds like a two-dimensional image. Now, one of the anthologists who anthologizes all the poskim in Yoredeya, because all these halachas are in Yoredeya, is the Darkei Moshe, and he says that although the Rambam seems to indicate that even two-dimensional images are prohibited, however, the Maharam, who's quoted by the Mordechai, these are the Ashkenazic Rishonim, states that drawing a two-dimensional picture of the sun, moon, and stars is permissible. Now, here we go back down in history to the Taz and the Shach. The Taz accepts the view, lekula, meaning leniency, of the Maharam. The Shach, on the other hand, accepts the stringency of the Rambam. And whether or not you're allowed to make pictures of the sun, moon, and stars on a piece of paper boils down to a machlokes between the Taz and the Shach. Now I'm going to test you. Maybe somebody in the audience will give you the answer. It's a 50-50 chance you get the right answer. In a machlokes between the Taz and the Shach, who do we postulate like? In almost all cases. Anybody know? Yeah. Like the Shach. For some reason, I mean, my Rebbe Rav Salvech used to give us a whole ethical, philosophical explanation why Hashkocha, why it was that divine providence we passing like the Shach against the Taz. The Taz, by the way, was probably sharper than the Shach. They were both brilliant, it's hard to say. But we usually passing like the Shach. In this case, it's a tremendous chumrah. Why? Because what we're going to say is that when the Torah prohibits you from creating images of the stars up in the heavens, it includes even images on a flat surface. Because that has the same status as shokea, as sunken images. And we accept the shita of the Shach based on the Rambam that we're not allowed to draw a picture of the sun. Now, this has tremendous repercussions. I mean, there are many children who are raised to make pictures, and they make a picture of the sun. Sometimes they just make a half a circle, and then they have like lines coming out, like rays of the sun. And the Darkei Tshuva says that this is also problematic because even though it's a half image of the sun, and we said before that maybe the Torah only prohibits when you make a complete image, the totality, but not a half image. But in this case, everybody who looks at the picture understands that that half image of the sun was only created as a half image because maybe you didn't have enough room on the page to create the whole sun. But everyone understood that this drawing is really a drawing of the sun. And therefore, on page 112, he quotes one of the poskim in contemporary life, Rav Eliyahu Falk, who says that one should not draw a picture even of the night sky when he leaves white spots because these spots clearly represent
stars.
Stars. Anybody ever hear of a painting, a very famous painting called Starry Night?
Yeah.
Yeah, who painted that painting? I'm just testing.
Van Gogh.
Okay, you call him Van Gogh. I call him Van Gogh. That's the way the Dutch pronounce it.
Van Gogh.
Van Gogh for the Americans, right?
Van Gogh.
But it's Van Gogh. One of those famous paintings is called Starry Night. According to this sheet in the poskim, Starry Night is prohibited. Now again, what does it mean is prohibited? It's prohibited to create it because it's stars. It's prohibited according to the Shach based on the Rambam, even though it's two-dimensional. It's prohibited even though you don't have a clear drawing of a complete star, but because you understand that those spots are the star. But I'm a millionaire. No. Let me correct myself. I'm a billionaire, and I can buy Starry Night. Am I allowed to buy Starry Night and own Starry Night? So that goes back to the Isur Shehiyah. Remember we said at the outset that there are two prohibitions. There's one prohibition, I'm with you in just a second, there's one prohibition of creating Starry Night, and now there's another prohibition of owning Starry Night, or shall we say, Shehiyah means, you know, keeping it. How does he translate here the word Shehiyah in the pages I gave you? I think he calls it retaining them, retaining Starry Night, okay? So my friends, if there are any people who will be back here next Wednesday because they love art, you might not want to come next Wednesday because we're really analyzing this from scratch. You know what I mean? We tend to just go to museums and we look at paintings and we enjoy them. Well, why do we do that? And that's what I want to discuss next week. And is it purposeful? Yeah.
Given these great concerns about not even looking at representations of things,
right,
how is it that we have linear custom halacha of Kiddush Levana, where we go outside?
You don't look at the moon.
How is one assured?
Right, but the halacha says you shouldn't be looking at it.
No, you shouldn't look at it.
But basically, you can't do it unless the moon is there.
Correct.
So that there's an implication that the moon being there is important and critical.
Important not because of the moon, but because the moon indicates that we can start a new month. Well, so what we're celebrating here is the new month, not the moon.
Given the fact that we're concerned about two-dimensional images that we don't have to look at, we don't have to do anything, how is it that we actually enforce going out and looking?
So again, only because I'm pressed for time, the best answer I can give you, we'll talk about it later after the Shia, is that again, Kiddush Levana has nothing to do with glorifying the moon. It only has to do with, again, you're going to have to wait until after the Shia because I can't take questions right now because I have an audience of people and I want to get to a certain part. Sorry, I apologize. But I'm here after the Shia. Let's talk about it. Any quick questions and then I want to go on.
Yeah.
You wanted to say something?
No, it's okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Excellent question. We'll talk about that too, Bulimeta. That's called Vikivshua.
Photographs.
Excellent question, photographs. Let's get to photographs. If we get to photographs today, in the next, what do I have left, 22 minutes, then I will bench Goebel, because then we achieve my goal for today. The real issue is going to be photographs. Okay, now, let's talk about the following. We said before that if you go to a museum, you will see sculptures, correct? Are they head to toe or are they busts? A bust means that it doesn't have the entire body. Now, there are different kinds of busts, but let's say the classic bust will have just the head, maybe up to the shoulders, but certainly not the rest of the body. So here we have a tshuva from Rav Kook. Rav Kook, as you know, was the first chief rabbi of Palestine. And he says the following, that if you look carefully and analyze the Shulchan Aruch, which is our code of law that was universally accepted, you will see that when he prohibits images, he's talking about a complete image, as we would say, head to toe. That's what's prohibited. Because again, if you're deifying someone, then you want to show the entire body. So for example, in the case of a bust, where you only have part of the body, that's not a complete image. It's an incomplete image. And if you read the Shulchan Aruch carefully, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, he allows that.
If
However, says Rav Kook, there is another opinion according to which we should be careful even about parts of the human body. And he says the following. If the sculpture was made in such a way that the artist deliberately wanted to create a beautiful representation of part of the body, then that would be prohibited, even though it's not a complete body. So that when the Shulchan Aruch says that you didn't create the whole body as an image, and therefore it's not included in this prohibition, the Shulchan Aruch did not make an absolute flat statement under all circumstances. What he meant was that if you only have part of the image, that's not something that could be confused with an idol. It doesn't engender feelings of adoration. At the end of the tshuva, Rav Kook writes the following. Technically, according to the strict law, as we read it in Shulchan Aruch, if there's no complete image, it's not included in this prohibition. However, he says, if a person were to take upon himself or herself an extra stringency to avoid even incomplete images of the body, then he says, Tovol Abracha, he should be blessed. Now, I just want to tell you this. Rav Kook was not known, he was not famous for adding these kinds of PS. You know, by the way, if you want to take upon yourself a stringency, I give you my blessing. You know, he was a Kohen, and he did give blessings. But if you read the tshuva carefully, and some of you may have a photocopy of the tshuva, I don't know, if not, I'll get it for you, Polinette, in the future, just remind me, then you'll see that even though he permits it, in Hebrew we say, yesh lo histaygut, you know, he's very, very inhibited about permitting it, but he says, I'm not going to go against the Shulchan Aruch. Now let's talk about images that are created for educational purposes, right? We're in an astronomy course, we want to teach astronomy. Now you may ask me, well, who's taking an astronomy course? And the answer is we're all taking an astronomy course. Why? Because the halacha requires that we study astronomy. The first mitzvah in the Torah is Kiddush HaChodesh. And in order to fulfill that mitzvah, we have to know a lot of astronomy. So take a look on page 113. And here we have a tremendous leniency of great significance in terms of artwork that is based on a Gemara in the same place in Avodah Zarah about Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was the Nasi, he was the chief of the entire Babylonian community, and he permitted images of the moon in order to, number one, teach students about Kiddush HaChodesh, and number two, to allow witnesses to clarify what they saw. Did they actually see the new moon? So very often he would test them by showing them an image of the moon and asking them if that's what they saw. The poskim, which the Rush, the Tour, we don't have to go through all the names here, say that we now have a category in which we're allowed to create images, and how much more so to retain ownership of the images, which is called lehislamed. Lehislamed means in order to learn something, in order to teach something. Now, here I want to ask the following question. We have a category here which might have tremendous application, tremendous scope of leniency. And that's lehislamed. What does lehislamed mean? I don't mean the translation here. I mean conceptually, what does it mean? Two possibilities. One possibility it means that it is so far removed from idol worship that it doesn't come under this prohibition. The purpose and the goal of this prohibition is to protect us from adoring something that might be considered an idol, that's an image, or it might lead us to idol worship in some sense. If it's lislamed, it's for educational purposes, that's taking it under a totally different category, a different purpose. And no one would jump from lislamed to adoration, to idol worship. That's one way of saying it. The other way of defining lislamed means that you're doing something for a purpose. As long as it has some sort of constructive purpose, then the Torah is going to allow it. That has a much, as we'll soon see, that has a much broader scope. Now, how do I have the audacity to suggest that maybe L'Slamed is indicative of a broader category, even if it's not strictly for educational purposes? So here we have a shach. Where is the shach? On page 114. Again, if there's anything that I want you to see inside, it's this unbelievable chiddush of the shach. Let me just, I just want to find the exact quote here so I don't misquote it. And he says the following. Just 1 second.
The seventh, eighth line.
What? Where is it? The seventh or eighth line on what page?
Start the shot. Number 114.
114. Thank you. Okay. The shach appears to go even further. Again, all of this is in Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya Kuf Mem Aleph. Again, for the scholars amongst you, if you want to look it up, the entire Simon Kuf Mem Aleph is dedicated to these laws of what images we're allowed to or not allowed to create. And the shach writes that he found machzorim, listen to this, and inside the machzor, they had images of constellations. I mean, that should be an open and shut violation of Lotasim Itin, because we're talking about the stars in heaven. How are they able to do so? So I thought that the shach was going to answer because it's two-dimensional and not three-dimensional. But if you recall that our earlier discussion, the shach holds, like the Rambam, that even in the case of sunken images, right, which are, let's say, two-dimensional on a tablet, even that's prohibited. So he doesn't have the option of allowing these machzorim to be published with images of constellations based on the fact that it is two-dimensional. So why is it not a violation of Lotasim Itin? And he says that this is considered lehislamim. Now, who are you teaching by adding a drawing of the constellations in a machzor? So if you take a look at the later poskim, for example, Rav Vosna, I don't know if you knew Rav Vosna, who died about maybe 5 years ago, he writes that the shach's expansive understanding of Islam should permit allowing children to draw pictures of the sun, moon, and stars. Now, here he adds three words, for educational purposes. Now, who am I? I'm a nobody, but I'm going to make the following comment. I would go even a step further. That if you accept the shach, and the children want to draw these pictures for pleasure reasons, in other words, they're future artists, so to speak, I don't mean that literally, then that also would be permissible. Because again, what the shach is saying, that l'slamed is a very broad scope. It doesn't mean strictly educational purposes, but it means for any purpose whatsoever. Once it comes under another goal or another purpose, that is one step removed from just creating images because you adore these images. Now, Rav Schechter is quoted here. I don't know, we'll have to ask him when he comes. When is he going to be here? No? I saw some advertisement, I didn't get a chance. Anyway, so he thinks that this leniency is hard to understand. That maybe we can't rely on the shach. So I always say the following. If you're going to rely on the shach l'chumra to tell you that you can't make images on a two-dimensional plane, then let's accept the shach's kula that l'slamed means if there's any constructive purpose in it, other than idol worship, then it could be mutter. Now, I want to add one last point here. How many people in this room may have heard of the Chacham Tzvi? The Chacham Tzvi, whose son was Rav Yaakov Emden, lived about 4.5 centuries ago in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, they were very heavy into art, and they wanted to portray the great Chacham Tzvi. They asked him to model for a painting, and guess what? You guessed it, he refused. Then they said to him, can we take at least an image of your face, meaning part of your body? So now we have two possible leniencies. Number one, it's on a two-dimensional surface. Number two, it's not the entire body. And he still refused. And Rav Yaakov Emden tells us that the only permission that you have, based on his father's chumrah, for creating human figures on a flat surface would be, just to quote him, if the face lacks facial qualities. Now, is there anyone here in the audience who might have heard of a great woman? I love her to pieces. Her name is Hoovy. She has a gallery right across the street from what's it called, the King David Hotel.
Right.
If you know Hoovy's work, and again, in my humble opinion, she's an absolutely fantastic Judaica painting, a very firm woman. She gives lectures on art to soldiers in the army that come to her apartment. Anyway, Hoovy will never make a painting with distinct features on the face. She has tons of paintings with human beings and images, but you'll never see the face in detail. And it's not because she's not capable of doing it, because I happen to own, and not an original, but I have a lithograph of one of her earlier paintings where, you know, that was before she became, you know, she's a Balas Tshuva. And it's unbelievable. As a realist painting, she is incredible. But yet, all the art that you'll see, if you go up here on, name of the street?
King David.
Oh, it's called King David Street, I forget. Yeah, if you go on King David Street and you take a visit, again, I don't get a commission for this, and you take a look at her art, you'll see that you will not find any distinct features. Now, the Chafetz Chaim Zichrono Livracha never let his picture take it. Do you know that? The only reason we now know who the Chafetz Chaim is, I mean, who he was and what he looks like, is because they dug up a video from like 100 years ago. I'm exaggerating, but not by much. It's close to 100 years ago, of the first Knesset Gedolah of the Aguda. And there are 6 seconds in which you can see the image of the Chafetz Chaim Sofer moving. And for me, like this, well, I was in seventh heaven because my father, may he rest in peace, got a bracha for the Chafetz Chaim, and is always wondering what the Chafetz Chaim really looks like. There's a classic painting of the Chafetz Chaim. It's not the Chafetz Chaim. Maybe it's his Balagol. We don't know who it is. But now we can see the Chafetz Chaim alive, moving on a video screen. It's pretty exciting. Now, I always thought that the reason why the Chasam Sofer did not want his picture taken is because of this Iser of Lo Sasun Iti. If we combine these two chumras, number one, that even in a case of a flat surface, two-dimensional, there's an Iser. Number two, even if it's not the entire body. However, it's not so. I'll tell you why. Because Rav Soloveitchik told us the following story, that there was once a cameraman who came to take a picture of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim started pushing him away. And then this cameraman must have been a bit of a Talmud Chacham. So he says to the Chafetz Chaim, this is what I heard myself from Rav Soloveitchik, he says to him, but Rebbe, the Gemara says about Yaakov Avinu, who's the last of the Avos, Dmus diyukno chakuka tachas kisei hakovet, that we have the image of Yaakov Avinu underneath the holy throne, up in Shemayim. Why? The answer is, because he's the last of the Avos. He's the last of that generation. And we have to have an image of what he looked like. And Rebbe, you are the last in that generation. We have to take an image. And the Rav said he let him take his picture. Hmm. So that would indicate that it was not the Chumrah of the Chacham Tzvi and the Ivitz, but a different reason entirely. Go figure out what that reason is. I do not know. How are we doing on the clock? We have 5 more minutes. I want to talk to you about cameras, about photography. Here we get into a real heavy issue in Halacha that's absolutely fascinating. And that is what's called grubba. What happens is, when I take a picture on a camera, I don't really create an image. There are a lot of steps along the way. So that I'm not violating lotasun. Again, I might be violating shahir because I own the photograph, but at least the more primary and severe prohibition of creating the image, I didn't violate. But you have a person who is developing the film. He's going to create the image. Well, what happens if he's Jewish? So I give my film to be developed by Yankel Berel, and I can't do that because if he's going to violate Lotasun Iti by creating an image, so I took a picture of a human being from head to toe, I took a picture of stars, you know, am I allowed to do this? And even if you assume that it's a problem with two-dimensional pictures, but my goodness, I'm not creating it. I'm giving it to him. But he's creating it. He's developing it. So the poskim say that he's developing it begrum. In other words, He's not taking his hands and creating that image. It goes through an entire process, step by step. And here we have one of the most important controversies. When I say important, I mean it's so far-reaching in modern life, in contemporary society. What is the status of grammar? Almost everything that we do is grammar. You turn on electricity, that's grammar. You have a tractor, and the tractor does the hoeing, and you just turn on the tractor and get it moving, that's grammar. Everything is grammar. You know, today they have people who never can't walk, so they have these grammar mobiles. You know what I mean? It's all based on grammar. Well, what is grammar? And here's where my Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, was a big machne. He felt that grammar, if it's a definite grammar, in other words, I know that within a certain period of time, but it may take minutes or even hours, but I know step by step it's going to happen because of my initial action, that's considered my action. And that's prohibited. But thank God the poskim did not accept that chumrah, and they allow grammar. Again, it doesn't mean that grammar is allowed in every situation. I'm not don't misunderstand me. But there's a fundamental difference between direct and indirect. So when you're taking a photograph, and it's going to be developed, but there's going to be an indirect creation of that image, then it's okay. And here you want to see a tshuva from Rav Avadi Yosef, and I'll just read quickly what he says. He says the following. He permits photography. Just one second, I got the wrong page. Where is it? It should be on page 117. I'm not sure if I got that far in the photocopies. But he says that it's okay. Now, let me just say in the next few minutes, my introduction to what I want to talk to you about next week. If you're here, that would be great. And again, I'm talking about those who appreciate art. If you don't appreciate art, you don't have to come next week. Unless you want to do Torah Lishma, as I said. But for those of us who appreciate art, we have the following problem. We're talking about art that may have pictures or illustrations of human beings. In many cases, it's a full portrait from head to toe. In other cases, it's a partial portrait. But that too, as we saw before, we accept the shach based on the Rambam. That's also included because iti, keep in mind that word iti, that we're very careful about images of human beings, and especially because we're aware of the idolatry of that religion that made a human being into a deity, and there are many other religions that did the same. So we have to be very careful about creating beautiful images of man. And even if you'll tell me it's two-dimensional, as I said before, we're going to go l'chumra, and we have to be strict about it. There are other things that you'll see in art. As we mentioned before, referring to one of the great Dutch painters, you'll see paintings of the sun, of the moon, of the stars, and even if it's not, you know, the entire painting is up in the heavens, but a large percentage, you know, of the paint, large chunk is. What would be the reason that would push us in the direction of appreciation of art? Why would we bother with art? We're a Jewish nation. We were never known as the most famous artists in history.
It's not that.
But yet, what we're going to try to prove next week is that there's an amazing amount of Judaic art that doesn't begin in the 21st century. It goes back a long time in Jewish history. What was the appreciation for art? Why? What was the motivation? What moved the Jewish people to create art? And what moves the Jewish people to this day to appreciate art? I was in a museum in Austria, and I met a man who tapped me on the shoulder. He saw I was Jewish, and he tells me that 90% of what I'm looking at in this museum was looted from the Jews. And the most famous painting of all, which Yimach Shemo Hitler had, was also stolen from a Jewish family. The immense and difficult, you know, legal battles that Jews are trying to do now in Austria, because finally the Austrian government changed its laws in which you could theoretically, and it's pretty theoretical, but you could actually sue for repossession of stolen, what they call looted art.
The Woman of Gold.
And there was the Woman of Gold, a movie about this, and I just ate dinner, my wife and I, with cousins of ours who just finished a 13-year legal battle in Austria to get possession of a painting. The museum lost the case, but they were not willing to give up the painting, but they worked out a deal that they would buy the painting. It's an amazing story in and of itself. So I'm going to stop here because I think we ran out of time. Wish everyone a Chodesh Tov, and thanks for coming. I just want you to walk away with the following ambivalence that we would try to clarify next week. What is the Torah? What is the Jewish halakhic attitude towards art? It's not so simple. Okay, then?
Yes, you can.
If anyone has any questions.
That's a great talk.
What about the clothing?
Excellent. There's an entire section, if you take a look at the photocopies, again, it's very hard to make it out about the Kruvim. You see that the Beis HaMikdash itself was so concerned in the Torah, and that's the architecture also of Bezalel, in physical beauty of physical objects. And maybe what the Torah is doing is it's giving us something to counter idol worship, and that's what the Kruvim is all about. But it's an excellent, excellent question. Any other questions? Okay, we'll stop.
But didn't Rav Kook say?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know which one was bigger, yours or Bob.
I thought.
What? Yeah, so I don't know, maybe it was mine.
Rabbi?
A technical question. I called in a few minutes late because I come from someplace else. And the references you gave, is there some other handout other than this?
Yes.
That I'm missing?
Yes, but they didn't have time to. It looks like this.
It looks like that. So then that's what I don't have. Because
right.
Everything that you referred to was not here.
Yeah. Well, no. 90% of what I referred to is here. At one point, I just referred to this page here on top.
Rabbi, didn't Rav Kook believe?
My initial apology with his tremendous technical difficulties and challenges with photographs.
I have to apologize because I come from someplace else or have something else going on that ends.
I read an essay from Rav Kook, or it was taken from an essay, that Rav Kook had a deep appreciation of art.
Yes.
And he felt that art really brought you to God.
Do you have a way of sending it to me? Because
what? The lecture?
I know that this is true, but did you have it on?
Yeah, recorded? Yeah.
Yeah, is it on internet or anything that you could send to me? I'll give you
I used to be able to, because it's a large file.
Oh, it's a large
file. These are large files.
Can you send me at least the title?
The title?
Meaning, can you help me? It would be a chesed for me if you would give it to me in a way that I could find it myself.
I'll try, because sometimes it's on Dropbox. I used to be able to do Dropbox, then it became more complex. Well, I just forgot to do because I wasn't sending out as many.
So,
but I'll find out. I'll talk to my son who's a lawyer, and I'll ask him the best way.
Would I be able to give you my WhatsApp or my email?
Sure.
Email's even better for me because it's easier for me to print from an email.
So this is the whole share on here.
Oh, so if don't erase it.
No, I'm not going to erase it. I don't.